News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Southern Illinois, I'm Todd Gleason. Welcome to the Closing Market Report for November the 16th, 2005. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets up with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. And later this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain in Terre Haute, Indiana. In a few moments, Dave Dickey will be along as well. That's to take a complete look at the day's agricultural news, and he'll stay with us for a bit today to discuss the Farm Service Agency and how that might change in the future. It all happens on this Wednesday edition of your Closing Market Report.
The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming on AM 580 as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists, on the web at a6395.com and at agrigold.com.
Joining us now for our look at the futures market is Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Paul, I'm not available to get hold of the numbers this afternoon because I'm on a farm in southern Illinois outside of Mount Vernon. Taking a look at some rotational grazing that the University of Illinois Extension has been working with. Could you update us on how the settlements came across for the day?
I sure can. On the grains, December corn 192 3/4, down 3. March corn 206 3/4, down 3 1/4. December 2006 corn at 241 1/4, down 3. January soybeans traded everywhere today, closing lower at 576 3/4, down 15 1/2. March beans 584 3/4, down 14 1/2, and November beans 603 1/2, down 13. December soybean meal 173.40, down 680. December bean oil 22.19, down 15. December oats 164 3/4, down 1/2. December wheat 306 3/4, down 1/4, and July wheat 339 1/2, down 1 penny.
Wow,
you want the mercantile?
If you could give me the merc, too, that'd be great.
December cattle, 91.70, unchanged. February cattle, 94.62, up 15. November feeder cattle, 116.47, up 10. December hog, 63.10, down 75. February hog, 66.92, down 22. And February pork bellies, 88.75, unchanged.
Paul, I had an opportunity to take a look at the numbers about mid-morning today on my way down and noticed that from then until this point that there's been a heck of a drop in the bean pit. I think they were narrowly mixed at that time, around 10:30 or so today. So what was it that got into the bean market for the day?
Well, there was this definite story about deaths from Asian bird flu in China. It started out with maybe 3 and worked up to 300 as the rumor mill started to pass some of the information along. There was also a story that the Germans were going to change the soy diesel tax on biodiesel fuel, and that also had an indirect influence on the bean oil. Usually with higher energy prices, the bean oil comes back. It was a basic sell-off, of course, in the corn market on the soybean as a relationship to the soybeans. The market broke through the 40-day moving average at 586. We did see the continuation of selling, only a light bounce in price recovery in the last few minutes of trade.
Now, the last thing I happened to see on the bird flu out of China, and that was early this morning as I left, that China had confirmed its first 3, but certainly not 300. This is a report out of China. 3 human cases of bird flu. In one state, the Ministry of Health there said 2 cases were registered in the central province and another one in the east. The brief announcement didn't give any further details of the bird flu, although I am told on other websites that I had been reading for the day that two of those, one was in a boy, one was in his mother, and then one possibly in a worker with the poultry flocks. How was it that the trade got from 3 to 300 is the question.
Well, there's a website that was out, and, you know, the one popular ag advisory service, Ag Resources, also quoted it as, you know, being a very substantial number. I think that basically, you know, filtered into the marketplace. We understand that business seems to be going on as far as soybean trade is concerned. It is a closed society, and you know the amount of information coming out of China to world information centers sometimes screened. That also had an indirect influence. I think the market suffered here because there has been some profit taking in the marketplace the last couple of days. The market was actually fairly dull, and we didn't see much bounce in the market. The president basically was in Japan and basically, I think, basically made the statement that China needs to become more of a democracy, and of course that kind of set the tone of what kind of discussions the Pacific Rim is going to be.
And then if you could go through this for me very quickly, because some who are listening and not initiated into the agricultural world will question probably why it is that the soybean market will react to a health issue in China.
Well, as we understand it, Todd, the numbers are rather intriguing that 20% of all the chicken population in the world is in China, and it's staggering the amount of poultry that's being consumed there in that country. Here, if we would see some kind of a shift in out of a particular type of meat, pork and beef would basically take the slack. Well, there the attitude is maybe fish would take the slack and into the diet. Why it's such a big factor is that it is big business. So the feed industry and corn and feed milling industry and processing industry over there, instead of the old days here where each farm manufactures, you know, its own, you know, feed source. We understand that feed mills, you know, deliver a lot of feed out to the countryside, and it's mixed and pre-mixed and actually fed out, you know, in service trucks. So it is a value-added process, and we understand that this is kind of a reaction from the marketing chain. We do feel that the basis levels will improve. There is a strong historic tendency for basis improvement. We are getting, you know, a lot of debate in the country on, you know, surveys west of the Mississippi indicate maybe a pretty good corn acreage next year. The surveys that we're hearing from, you know, certain organizations say maybe more beans east of the Mississippi. So, you know, there's a definite difference between west of the Mississippi and east of the Mississippi, and, of course, fertilizer costs are the bottom line.
And the big concern there would be just exactly how Illinois turns on that particular dime, number one usually in beans, number two in corn, behind the state of Iowa, and every now and then that changes around.
You know, one of the things that our surveys do indicate that there is a large group of farmers that still are waiting and measuring everything and are up in the air, so to speak. But we are definitely of the opinion from the other people that we are seeing, you know, seed corn sales, some fertilizer, and actually comments from producers of, you know, some cutbacks in the corn acres.
Well, I have a question about this. You suggested that Iowa, or at least some of the surveys are saying Iowa may go to more corn. There's been a movement towards one-third, two-thirds corn there anyway. Over the past several years, and certainly Iowa, Minnesota, Nebraska are awfully good at raising corn. Even if we lose acreage, is it possible that we might not lose total supply next year?
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, we even go so far as to why the big, you know, why are they still playing the game in corn? Well, their corn yields were excellent, A. B, the the co-op system was very aggressive at booking anhydrous ammonia for their farmer customers at some very cheap prices. There was a little more encouragement by the fertilizer industry to book lock-in values, and they had a good crop going along, so a lot of guys put two and two together and went to the fertilizer plant and booked a lot of fertilizer. I think the other thing is that even with a little higher fertilizer price, with big corn yields and big LDPs, it was a big banner year for those producers west of the Mississippi, and there is a tendency to play the old game of playing it for the big gross that corn does provide the producer.
Before I let you go today, let's do talk about the LDP just a bit. Made note yesterday that it had dropped to 37 cents in the state of Illinois. Didn't get a chance to look at it today.
Well, it looks like when I looked at it, looked it up here recently, but we'll have it here quickly for you. It looks like the average in corn's 36 cents.
So it has dropped another penny. And any suggestions about what farmers should do with unpriced grain that they have now in storage?
Well, a couple things about the unpriced corn. We are hearing two things, and it's very notable that, if you're around a ethanol plant, some of those prices are just absolutely, great. And, that's a factor. And we will see that basis improve in people, 10 miles, 20 miles around those areas can take advantage of those. Number two, we do think that probably $2 a bushel will move a lot of corn in January. And as a result of that, that's in my book, that's like $2.15 to $2.20 in July. There'll be corn move, and we do think that the prices will appreciate. It's extremely dry west of the Mississippi, and, that's another additional factor. Farmers are strongholders of corn and soybeans.
Paul, we appreciate you being with us today.
Have a profitable day, Todd, and a safe trip back.
Thank you very much. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services out of Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on Wednesday afternoons. Well, at the bottom of the hour, meteorologist Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City will join us for a look at the agricultural weather. Dave Dickey and I are both on the road today. I'm in Mount Vernon with University of Illinois Extension, taking a look at a program called Annie's Project and discussing a little bit about what might be happening in the future with rotational grazing. You'll hear that on the Closing Market Report, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. Also, Dave Dickey is headed to Vincennes this evening at 7 o'clock. Eastern time, that's Indiana time, where he will be in the Technology Center of Vincennes University, along with Tim Young, Clayton Pope, and Mike Zuzolo. You're invited there for a look at what's been happening in the marketplace at a free AM 580 Ag panel. That's tonight at 7 o'clock at the Vincennes University Technology Center in Vincennes, Indiana. And Dave will be along in just a moment to tell you about today's Ag News.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Chip Jorstad in Morris at 815-941-3706. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
In agricultural news, China's Ministry of Health today confirmed that nation's first three human cases of bird flu, including two cases in the central Hunan province. Chinese and World Health Organization experts had been studying the case of a 12-year-old girl who died in Hunan province and her brother, both of whom fell ill after their village suffered a bird flu outbreak in poultry. The boy survived. China has reported 11 outbreaks of avian influenza in chickens and ducks over the past month in areas throughout the country, prompting authorities to destroy more than 2.5 million birds in an effort to contain the virus. The Canadian International Trade Tribunal, or CITT, yesterday ruled that unprocessed U.S. corn entering into Canada hurts Canada's domestic sector, but processed U.S. corn does not. The CITT, an independent body that reports to Parliament, determined that under the terms of the Special Import Measures Act, the dumping and subsidizing of unprocessed grain corn has hurt Canada's domestic industry. Duties could be levied on the goods brought into Canada if there is a large increase in harmful imports, and the CITT decides it is justified in applying such retroactive anti-dumping measures. The ranking Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee has gotten a jump on his colleagues by introducing a bill that would extend provisions of the 2002 Farm Bill. Representative Colin Peterson, a Democrat from Minnesota, joined with fellow Agriculture Committee member Jim Costa, a Democrat from California, to propose a measure that would extend the Farm Bill's commodity title through the 2008 crop year and extend the remaining titles through either fiscal year or calendar year 2008. Peterson says the measure is an effort to strengthen the U.S. negotiating position in the Doha round of World Trade Organization talks.
The message that we're giving out in our embassies, our ag attachés, our trade representatives that are stationed around the world, they're telling other countries that the United States is trying to get rid of their farm programs. I've actually had representatives of the United States government ask me how I could hold my head up and not be embarrassed about what the United States is doing to support our agriculture. So this is the attitude we've got out there.
Meanwhile, World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz says the global economy stands to gain $300 billion if the Doha round is successfully completed. Wolfowitz says developing countries will gain the most. Pacific Rim trade ministers, including the U.S., agreed Tuesday on a joint statement aimed at reviving stalled global trade talks, but stopped short of naming the European Union as the main stumbling block in negotiations. Breaking a deadlock in the WTO over subsidies in the heavily protected farming sectors of Europe and some other developed countries has become a key focus of the Asia-Pacific Economy Corporation Forum meeting in South Korea. A company called Earth First Americas this week announced its first shipment of palm oil-based biodiesel arrived in Florida from Ecuador on November 8th. The company says biodiesel imports could total 45 million gallons in 2006 and 100 million gallons in 2007. American Soybean Association President Bob Metz immediately cried foul. Metz says Congress never intended for the new biodiesel production tax credit to apply to imported biodiesel.
We were looking at building industry here in the United States, and that was certainly the intent of the tax legislation. Unfortunately, several months ago, as the IRS started looking at the legislation, they ruled that any biodiesel could receive the tax incentive.
Metz is calling on Congress to impose a tariff on imported biodiesel, but Illinois Democratic Senator Barack Obama says the answer is new incentives for production of domestic biodiesel, including a 2 billion gallon renewable fuel standard by 2015.
What my bill does is to send a signal that the government's committed to more domestic production capacity of biodiesel. That, I think, should be our number one priority. We're not trying to create markets for folks overseas when we could potentially be building up markets for our farmers here at home.
The National Biodiesel Board says U.S. production of biodiesel quadrupled this year and is expected to expand nearly as quickly in 2006. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. Citing opposition from lawmakers, USDA announced last month that it had discarded plans to close more than 30 Farm Service Agency offices in Illinois and more than 700 nationwide. But behind the scenes, FSA officials are now evaluating what went wrong with its FSA Tomorrow approach and timetable. Teresa Lassiter is the FSA's new administrator, hired after former Chief James Little's unexpected resignation after news of the closure plan was made public. Lassiter was once head of Lee County, Georgia's FSA office. She says a new national plan will need to emerge to deal with the inefficiencies in county FSA offices.
FSA tomorrow is dead as far as the exact plan we had, but we've got to do a business study of our states and make sure that we are providing where the services need to be, that our offices are located in the right places. As you probably know, we have many offices that either have no employees in them or one or two, and it's hard to imagine that we can provide good service with offices that aren't adequately staffed. So we are going to be looking at what we can do to better serve our farmers. That's what it's all about. This is not, as the Secretary said, this is not about who won or lost in FSA tomorrow, but rather about what we can do to better serve the farmers and ranchers and position ourselves for tomorrow, for doing a better job forever.
Little resigned after USDA announced it was beginning a modernization program that would have resulted in about 850 fewer budgeted positions in fiscal year 2006. While some of the cuts would have come through attrition, FSA would have also offered buyouts or early outs to 321 county and 214 federal employees. Lassiter says that while calls for budget reductions on Capitol Hill are driving the discussion, a new modernization plan must germinate with Congress and the grassroots.
First of all, we're interested in talking to our congressional people and doing a better job of explaining to them what our goal is here and why we are taking the approach that we had planned to take, why we thought that was the approach to take. So we're going to do a better job of getting input from the local level and from the state level. Maybe that was missing before. Maybe we need to go out there and ask their ideas. That's something that we're talking about now, is getting ideas from the local level up instead of just giving direction from the top down.
Heavy pressure in both the House and Senate torpedoed the original FSA Tomorrow plan. Still, Lassiter says computer equipment must be upgraded at FSA offices nationwide. As for a timeline for a new FSA modernization plan, Lassiter says expect to see something before the current Farm Bill expires at the end of 2006.
We'll see in the days to come, and it's going to be sooner than later that we're talking about this, because we do need to be positioned before the next Farm Bill is in law to get it out to our customers.
Lassiter insists whatever new plan emerges, it won't be about closing a specific number of FSA offices, but rather ensuring employees are placed where they can serve the needs of the greatest number of agricultural producers. This is Dave Dickey, AM 580 Agriculture.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is Todd Gleason coming to you today from the Mount Vernon farm of Ken and Ruth Hamilton. I'm here taking a look at rotational grazing and how producers of beef and dairy might be able to take advantage of the pasture that's available in the state of Illinois and across the Midwest, with Mr. Sexton out of the University of Illinois Extension Office here, along with a program called Annie's Project that Ruth Hamilton, who happens to be a University of Illinois Extension employee as well, has been putting together to help producers' wives and farm wives across the Midwest learn more about the farm and how it operates. So we'll hear more about those sometime in the future. Our thanks, by the way, to Henry Frayne, who is at the controls there in Champaign, and making sure that we get on the air properly. So I'm here in Mount Vernon, Henry's in Champaign, and if I don't miss my guess, we'll be joined now by Kay Whitlock of Terre Haute Grain in Terre Haute, Indiana, to talk about the cash grain market. Hi, Kay. How are you doing this afternoon?
Todd, I'm just fine. Is it as cold down there as it is up here?
I tell you what, when we started out this morning, it wasn't particularly, but I think it was around, we didn't get on the road until about 9 o'clock or so. I think we left, it was 31 degrees, and the further south we got, I thought it would warm up, but it didn't until we got into the later afternoon and ran to about 39 degrees, I think, here in Mount Vernon at this hour. But it's cold, comparatively speaking, for the day, that's for sure.
Yes, it is.
That probably means there are a lot of farmers bundled up and thinking, man, I don't look forward to moving grain in January, and they're thinking it's awfully cold today, and I bet they're not moving grain today either.
It has really quieted down here, Todd. Harvest is basically over with. They've slammed the doors. They've walked away. There are a lot of them checking on prices, checking on 06 prices in January 07. Very little booking, and, you know, they've got their LDPs. They've got a little cash in their hands. So for right now, they're just very content to sit back and watch this market, but naturally they're very concerned.
And we're running a little short on time today, so if you could just give me your bids for the day, I'd appreciate it.
I certainly will. Cash corn is 175, cash beans 551, and new crop wheat today is 315.
Thanks much, Kay.
Thank you, Todd.
Kay Whitlock is with Terre Haute Grain out of Terre Haute, Indiana. She joins us here on the Closing Market Report on Wednesday afternoons. In about 2 minutes, I'll take a look at the agriculture weather with meteorologist Drew Lerner. Your local newscast is next.
With this look at AM 580 News, I'm Jim Meadows. Governor Rob Blagojevich signed a new Illinois law today designed to make it harder for drug dealers to get the ingredients used to make methamphetamine. It requires stores to keep popular cold medications such as Sudafed behind counters. To get those medications, buyers have to be at least 18 and sign a log subject to police inspection. The National Weather Service says two tornadoes struck Indiana during the storms that raked the state yesterday. Meteorologist John Ogren says one of the tornadoes cut a path through Davis County, causing damage in the towns of Washington, Montgomery, and Cannellburg, before pushing into Martin County, where the town of Bramble sustained damage. The second tornado hit Bartholomew County, causing damage near the town of Hope, before pushing into Shelby County. A Vermilion County, Illinois judge has sentenced a 21-year-old Danville man to 35 years in prison for killing his former girlfriend, a one-time Danville High School track star. Judge Thomas Fahey sentenced Justin Bell yesterday for the April 5th stabbing death of 19-year-old Winneva Johnson, who had a child with Bell. A budget plan for Vermilion County includes a 20% increase in county property taxes and the elimination of funding for about 15 county jobs. The Vermilion County Board voted last night to put the budget plan and tax levy out for public review. The vote came 1 week after county board members rejected an earlier budget plan with a bigger tax hike. A final vote is set for November 30th. Champaign City planners say they hope to address any concerns about the development of the old Burnham Hospital site within the next few weeks. The Champaign Plan Commission holds a study session this afternoon on the plan for apartments and possible retail space at the site. They hope to forward an agreement with the developers to the City Council in early December. Planners say their biggest concerns include providing enough parking space for the proposed 250-unit luxury apartment complex. I'm Jim Meadows, AM 580 News.
I'm Todd Gleason, AM 580 Agriculture. You're listening to the Closing Market Report coming to you today live from the farm table here in the kitchen that belongs to Ken and Ruth Hamilton outside of Mount Vernon, Illinois, down doing some of my work for University of Illinois Extension. In fact, I just made note that if I look out the kitchen window here, there's just a beautiful sight. The Black Baldies, those are cattle for those who don't know, are being moved from one of the rotational grazing pastures to another by my cameraman, who happens to be Steve Parker. He's with me most of the time, does a lot of the video that you might see on Channel 12 or Ag Day or some U.S. Farm Report or some of the other TV programs in the area. And Ruth and her two daughters are moving those calves from one pasture to another. And it's just a beautiful day this afternoon. Sunshine skies here, I suspect it, in the area of Champaign, that it's not nearly that clear. At least it wasn't when I left this morning. Drew Lerner is in on the phone right now, from Kansas City to tell me whether I've got that right or not. Hi, Drew. How are you today?
I'm all right. I think you have a pretty good idea what's going on, as usual. We do have snow that's falling periodically across the western Great Lakes region. It does look like the pattern is going to be one that we're going to see a lot of over the next 10 days. Frequent disturbances coming southeastward out of Canada will bring a high frequency of snow and snow shower activity across the Midwest, especially northern and eastern portions of the region. I don't see any major leak storm systems like what we just saw in the last 24 hours again anytime soon, but we will continue to see waves of light snow move across the region, along with a little drizzle, maybe some freezing drizzle once in a while in northern areas, and then our temperatures will likely stay on the cooler side of normal for an extended period of time.
I'd like to know more about those cooler temperatures, especially out west, and what kind of impact they might or might not be having on the wheat crop that's been growing so well and the warm temperatures this fall.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we shocked the crop pretty good in the last 24 hours. If you recall, last Saturday's high temperatures out there in the plains were in the 80s. This morning, we were 7 degrees above zero in North Platte, Nebraska, and had single-digit readings all the way down into the northern parts of the Texas panhandle. This is certainly an extreme, but I don't think it's hurting the crop in a dramatic sense. Certainly shocked the plants, pushing some of them into dormancy rather quickly. Other areas will continue to have warm soil temperatures for an extended period and probably won't even see dormancy kick in for very long. But we are expecting the cool conditions to continue tonight, and then after that I think we'll probably see temperatures near to slightly warmer than usual out there in the plains. I think that the concern about dryness in hard red wheat country is likely to continue for a while. I see no major storm systems, not even a good shower chance coming along anytime real soon. We may have to wait about 10 days before we get another chance for rainfall out there. It's extremely dry in West Texas. The panhandle there, where so much wheat is produced, has not seen more than a half inch of moisture since the 1st of October, and we don't expect to see anything for 10 more days.
Drew, we appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you, and have a good day.
You too. Drew Lerner is the Senior Agricultural Meteorologist at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. I'm Tom Gleason, coming to you today from the Mount Vernon area. We hope you had a good afternoon, and by the way, remember, you can tune in to everything on our website. It'll be a little bit delayed, as I won't be back in the office until later, but it'll be up later this afternoon. There at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Just click on AM, and as always, agriculture. I'm Todd Gleason.